So, I'm very pleased to introduce Ramesh, Ramesh Patni, who's a DPhil student here, and you're still actually you're still involved in Hindu Christian.
Yes, I'm still in all those things as well.
Okay. The seminar or lecture he'll give today is part of a series that was conceived last term in exploring some of the key theological sort of issues in the Hindu traditions, and so he'll start it by talking about suffering, causes, and the ultimate cure, a view from classical yoga of Patanjali. So I'll hand it over to you.
Thank you very much. So I'm just going to read out the paper, and then towards the end I've got a diagram which I will kind of give it out. I don't want to give it out now, but I'll give it out later, which will then kind of bring all the elements together, and then, you know, it'll form a basis for your questions as well, if you have any. Okay, suffering, causes and ultimate cure, a view from classical yoga of Patanjali. It is recognized by almost all the cultures and religions, traditions of the world, that there are imperfections in human existence and the human condition, and these are expressed in the experiences of misery, anxiety, and suffering. If human existence was taken to be ideal or perfect, then there is no reason why one should reflect on it, indeed do anything about it. When the imperfections are recognized, it becomes a human endeavor to find solutions to these by various means, whether it be physical, mental, spiritual, and indeed all religions have attempted to provide answers to the question of human suffering. The view of Buddha about the human condition is well known, expressed in the remark that all is dukkha. And this term is translated in many ways, including anxiety, discomfort, misery, stress, uneasiness, but all ideas centering around the idea of suffering. The eternal cycle of birth and death, or samsara, is the reality of the human condition, and the imperative, according to Buddha, is to liberate oneself from the cycle which is full of dukkha or suffering. The Sankhya system of thought in Hinduism quite explicitly states that human experience is sorrowful and that this torment leads to a desire for ending it. In the foundational text of the Sankhya philosophy, the Sankhya Karika, the opening verse itself says, "From the torment caused by the three kinds of pain proceeds a desire for inquiry into the means of terminating them. If it be said that the inquiry is superfluous, since visible means exist, we reply, not so, because in the visible means there is the absence of certainty and the permanency of pain." So this is kind of describing the human condition in this way. The Karika commentator, who is Vachaspati Mishra, explains that such an inquiry would not take place if there existed no pain in this world, or if existent, its removal was not desired, or if desired, its removal was not possible. And therefore you have this kind of inquiry which comes about. The three kinds of pain, the triad of pain, or dukkhatraya, adhyatmic pain, which is caused by internal physical and mental conditions, the adibhautik, external and natural causes, and the adidevik, which is the supernatural causes, can be relieved by the discriminative knowledge of the manifest, the unmanifest, and the knower or the seer. And this is called vyakta avyakta jnana vijnanat, which is vyakta is manifest, avyakta is unmanifest, and jnana vijnanat is the discrimination between that which is manifest and that which is unmanifest. The knowledge of the manifest precedes the knowledge of the unmanifest, which is the cause of the former, and from this arises the direct knowledge of the self, the true self, called the Purusha or the cognizer. Here what is being referred to are the two unmanifest primordial categories of Sankhya, which is Purusha and Prakriti, which coming into conjunction, which is called the process of Samyoga, gives rise to the manifest. It is through the discriminating knowledge between the unmanifest and the manifest that the knowledge of the Purusha or pure consciousness arises, at which point all suffering ends. The classical text of yoga, the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali, which is based on this Sankhyan metaphysic of Purusha and Prakriti, we have a detailed practical application of this epistemological solution to the ontological problem. The entanglement of the Purusha with the evolutes of Prakriti leads to the development of the individual identity, where the Purusha gets identified with the workings of the evolutes of Prakriti, as it were, and comes to experience suffering in this condition, in this individual identity. The primary concern of yoga is to achieve disentanglement of these two principles through yoga praxis, leading to a state of kaivalya or aloneness, referring to the reclaiming of the pure Purusha. And it is this state of kaivalya that all three types of suffering come to an end. The methodology of yoga is set out in a systematic formulation of Ashtanga Yoga and Kriya Yoga in the Yoga Sutra, which ultimately remove dukkha from its very roots. The Sanskrit term dukkha is usually translated as suffering or pain and misery, but just as in the Buddhist interpretation of the Pali word, we see various shades of meaning of this term. The general import of the word in relation to the human condition can be given by the story of a king named Brihadaratha in the Maitri Upanishad, who abdicates his throne in favor of the son. Having reached a state of vairagya or complete indifference to the world, he approaches a holy man called Sakyana, who offers him a boon. The old king, saying that he wants nothing else and only ask for the knowledge of the self or Atman, says that in this body, which is afflicted by desire, anger, covetousness, delusion, fear, despondency, envy, separation from the desirable, union with the undesirable, hunger, thirst, senility, death, sorrow, and disease, and the like, what is the good of enjoyment of desires? It only leads towards suffering. In this story, we get a sense of two movements indicated in the quest for removal of dukkha. One movement, which leads towards the phenomenal existence of identity, and the other, which leads away from the phenomenal existence, called vairagya, and in the second, which takes one towards the true knowledge, the knowledge of Atman. And these are the two movements which can be discerned in this story of Brihadaratha. So what is this vairagya? Vairagya is the dispassion that arises through the discriminative knowledge and a consequent disinterest in the phenomena of the world and the experience of the individual. A seeking and attainment of knowledge of the Atman is also through various levels of discrimination, and it is only when one gets established in this knowledge of Atman that dukkha is permanently removed. According to the Bhagavad Gita, which is the essence of all Upanishads, this state is the state of sthita prajna, or established in the true knowledge. Patanjali says that for the person of discrimination, vivekana, everything is dukkha. The discriminating persons, this is a quotation of his sutra number 15 from chapter number 2, it says, the discriminating person apprehend by analysis and anticipation all worldly objects as sorrowful, because they cause suffering in consequence in their afflictive experiences and in their latencies, and also because of the contrary nature of the gunas, which produces change all the time. The means, according to Patanjali in his treatise called the Yoga Sutra, to attain the state of Kaivalya, which has the connotation of being established in the true knowledge, is the means of the yoga. Here the underlying metaphysic refers to the true knowledge of the self as the Purusha, who is also called the Drushtu or the seer, and establishing oneself in this seer is the goal of yoga. But the definition of yoga given by Patanjali in the second verse of the Yoga Sutra is yogas chitta vritti nirodha, which means the cessation of the modifications of the mind. So the question arises now as to what is the relationship between the cessation of chitta vritti, or the modifications of the mind, and the state of kaivalya, or the establishment of the seer. Patanjali systematically develops this pathway whereby from the non-yogic states of mind, yogic states are arrived at by changing the klishta vritti or afflicted modifications to aklishta vritti or unafflicted modifications by means of discriminative knowledge. This is now in the initial stages of yoga practice, which eventually leads to states of intense absorption called samadhi, and finally cessation of all modifications of the mind. We will look at this complete pathway from kshipta, or the agitated state of mind, of the non-yogi to the chitta vritti nirodha, or the still mind of the yogi, which, having attained this state, brings about the end of all suffering. So let us start by understanding some of the terms which have been used. We translate the word chitta as the mind, but there are various translations of chitta in the literature, such as mind, mind stuff, mind complex, psyche, consciousness, and awareness. One of the reasons for this variety of is that Patanjali himself does not provide an explicit definition of the term, although the meaning can be ascertained from its 22 occurrences in the verses of the Yoga Sutra. Feuerstein states that it is impossible to find a single label for chitta in English. Koelmann also states that the chitta is not a separate evolute or prakriti, being the same as some of its main components. And these components, according to him, consist of the antakarna, literally meaning the inner instrument, made up of the buddhi, the intellect, mana, the mind, and the ahankara, which is the I-sense. According to Sen Dasgupta, chitta stands for all that is psychical in man. Feuerstein also calls this chitta an umbrella term, which denotes all functionings of the mind, the entire mental machinery. Keeping these various meanings in view, we will denote chitta simply as mind. The concept of vrittis is also another key element in Patanjali's Yoga Sutra. The word is derived from the Sanskrit root vritta, which has the meaning of to turn, whirl about, revolve, roll, proceed, and these various translations have been given for this term of the Yoga Sutra as fluctuations, modifications, accent functions, transformations, etc. For our purpose, we will employ the term modification, as it captures many of the nuances of the term. Again, there is difficulty in finding a single label in English for vritti. The modifications indicated by Patanjali are of five different kinds, and the sixth sutra in the first chapter lists these five categories of modification which occur in the chitta as valid cognition, pramana, misconception, viparyaya, conceptualization, vikalpa, sleep, nidra, and memory, smriti. So if you consider your own case, you will see various different modifications are taking place now, and hopefully it's not nidra Okay. It's not sleep.
Not so far.
So these innumerable mental modification that take place moment to moment can be put into this any of these five categories enumerated by Patanjali. These, according to Witcher, who is also another commentator on Yoga Sutra, include the cognitive conditions, mental, emotive, affective content, processes and activities of the mind. In fact, any actor, content of consciousness, self-identity or mode of consciousness operating in the mind itself. These activities in the chitta are all highly significant for the practice of yoga as they contribute to the continued entanglement of the Purusha and the Prakriti and generate the mistaken identity with the prakritic instruments of the body and the mind and the intellect, which keeps the individual bound to the phenomenal existence. These modifications of vritti are classified by Patanjali in two general categories, namely the afflicted modifications, which I already mentioned, klishta vritti, which takes the individual towards bondage and suffering, and the non-afflicted modification, aklishta vritti, which take the yogin towards liberation and relief from suffering. In the Patanjali Yoga Sutta, there is a very striking metaphor of the mind found in the commentary of Vyasa on the 12th sutra of the first chapter, which gives us a sense of these two different kinds of modification, which reads, "The river called mind flows in two directions. Chitta nadi nam ubhayato vahini," which means that the river of the mind flows in two directions. An understanding of this powerful metaphor, which is descriptive as well as evaluative, helps one to perceive how closely the psychological, the moral, and the soteriological aspects are interwoven into the yoga view of the incessant modifications of the mind. The imagery of the two directions transforms the flow of mental life into something more than a mere psychological description. The two directions are, at first, characterized as flowing towards good and towards evil. Vahati kalyanaya and vahati papayacha, which expresses primarily an ethical consideration. A further description, however, specifies that which flows towards discrimination, viveka, and isolation and salvation, kevalya, is good, whereas that which leads towards worldly existence, samsara, is evil. Clearly indicating a soteriological perspective. This metaphor of the mind as river flowing in two directions, however, acquires a specific technical significance, as we have seen that Yoga Sutra introduces these two broad division of all modifications of mind, classifying them in klishta and aklishta vritti. This distinction, which is of vital importance for yoga soteriology, involves the notion of klesha, which we will see in much more detail later. But for now, the subtle distinction in discerning the meaning of the word can be seen in the commentaries of the Yoga Sutra. Klishta vritti are those state of mind, as stated in the Vyasa Bhashya, which are caused by klesha, klesha hetuka. Whereas the Yoga Vartika of Vignan Bhikshu, who is also another commentator on the Patanjali Yoga Sutra, describes these afflicted modifications as those which lead to suffering. So the mind which is considered as flowing in two directions, one towards liberation, the other towards bondage, becomes the primary instruments of prakriti which needs to be subject to sadhana or practice in order to move it towards liberation. In the practice of yoga, the afflicted vritti, which take the individual towards identification and bondage through aviveka, which is non-discrimination, are replaced by the non-afflicted vritti, taking one towards purification and liberation through viveka or discrimination. Now, looking at the term klesha, generally translated as affliction, this is another technical term which Patanjali introduces at the beginning of the second chapter. After stating the three elements of Kriya Yoga as tapas, discipline, swadhyaya, self-study, and Ishwar Pranidhana, he goes on to state that the purpose of this yoga kriya or yoga practice is to klesha tanu karana arthascha, which is to say these practices bring about the weakening of the causes of suffering, kleshas, and take one towards samadhi or absorption. So in other words, Kriya Yoga, with these three aspects of Kriya Yoga, Tapas, Swadhyaya and Ishwar Pranidhana, are the means by which one can weaken these kleshas or the causes of suffering. The import of the term klesha becomes further evident as one reads Yoga Sutra, Sutra number 3, which puts forward a concise list of these five kleshas or afflictions. These are avidya, asmita, raga, dvesha, and abhinivesha. These are the panchaklesha or the five klesha. These may be translated as nescience or ignorance, eyesense, desire, aversion, and fear, principally of death. The question arises as to what do these five have in common that allows for their designation as klesha, which leads to suffering of the individual. These are precisely the five factors within the individual that drive the mind towards all that is of this world, samsara, and at the same time block the discriminative knowledge, this knowledge being essential for liberation or kaivalya. In this connection, it is interesting to recall that these five afflictions or panchaklesha are also designated as the five erroneous cognitions or panchavipariyaya. So klesha, klishta, aklishta, these are the words we have heard. And these are the three related concepts that are central to yoga psychology of suffering and are derivatives of the root word klish, meaning to torment, be troubled, and so on. Klesha in the overall sense means the cause of affliction, which Zimmer states as anything which, adhering to man's nature, restricts or impairs the manifestation of his true essence. Koelman offers another explanation of klesha. He says, man is born with certain psychological habits, congenital psychical passions that bind him to cosmic conditions. They blind him, prevent him from discovering what his genuine self is, make him attached to the cosmic life and its allurements, afflict his existence with an endless chain of woes, enmesh him more and more in the net of conditioned existence and hinder his liberation, unquote. The klesha principle in the Yoga Sutra is described by Feuerstein as that which is said to circumscribe the fact that every organism, on attaining self-consciousness, finds itself in the existential situation where it has become aware of its own self-awareness but has become confused as to the true nature of this awareness. And the organism, as it were, is compelled to act out of a false identity. This is what klesha is described as by Feuerstein. This false identity resulting from asmita, the affliction of individuation, leads to the ongoing misidentifications of selfhood and the modifications of the mind. The primary affliction of ignorance or avidya is at the root of all the other four kleshas. In other words, the pancha klesha are related together, and at the root of all these five klesha is the affliction of avidya. The attachment, raga, and aversion, dvesa, the emotive context of the klesha, signify the affective dimension of the vritti. The impressions created by pleasurable experiences give rise to the state of attachment, which leads to efforts towards attainment of the object of pleasure or desire. The aversion or dvesha is produced with a recollection of painful experiences as a result of such past impressions. In other words, the logic of the Yoga Sutra is that suffering is the very condition of the unenlightened human being. This condition arises because the klishta vritti, or the afflicted modifications of the mind and the impressions they create through actions, the karma, saya, create a vicious cycle of impressions and experiences between them, which leads to vikshepa, a disturbed state of mind, through the nine types of experiences, which I'll mention later, and constant transaction with the world. These then, according to Patanjali, result in four things. One is dejection. Number two, instability in the body. Number three, irregular breathing, inhalation and exhalation, and suffering in the body and the mind. It is also important to understand the notion of samskara, which is translated as impression. It is said that any vritti or state that arises in the mind leaves behind it a trace, a samskara, which in turn can provoke and reinforce a similar state in terms of one's future experience. Whereas the karmasaya, impressions created through action in the world, are regarded as ekbhavika, or related to one life, samskara accumulated over many lives result in what is known as vasanas, which are inclinations and tendencies carried forward in future life and acquired from all the past lives. The example given by Dasgupta in Yoga Philosophy, an interesting example here, is saying that the fructification of the karmasaya, if they result in a dog life, then at once his corresponding vasanas of a previous dog life are revived and he begins to take interest in the dog life in the manner of a dog. Thus, Yoga Sutra speaks of this perpetual wheel of modifications and impressions, which is called the Vritti Samskar Anisam Chakram. So a samskara is not merely a memory trace, but also a latent tendency, a propensity, which is often compared to a seed that germinates under favorable conditions. This view also maintains that the vrittis, or the modifications of the mind, are always known, but that does not hold true for samskara and the vasanas, which are subliminal. They may be described as subliminal impressions and tendencies which remain unobserved or unconscious. Viparyaya is another term which requires elaboration to understand the underlying logic of yoga practice and the removal of suffering. To put it briefly, it is a general term for those states of mind which are discerned as erroneous cognitions and which can be negated or corrected by valid means of cognition, which is pramana. And thus, if the I sense, desire, aversion, fear of death are labeled as klesha, and also as viparyaya, it means that each of this affliction gives rise to erroneous view of things. The significance of this description is that it is through the discriminative knowledge that the wrong cognitions can be removed. This is the same as saying that the causes of affliction, the klesha, are removed by this method of discrimination of viveka in the first place. So, coming back to these causes of afflictions or suffering, let's examine the five kleshas described by Patanjali in a bit more detail so that we can understand where this suffering is arising from and what is the solution to these causes of suffering. So, if you start with avidya or nescience, ignorance, heading the list of affliction is precisely this latent subliminal tendency, vasana, of erroneous thinking, and it is described as the kshetra, or the field, and the prasava bhumi, breeding ground, for the four that follow. This implies that all the klishta vritti, or the afflicted modifications of the mind, share the main characteristic of avidya klesha, a predisposition, so to speak, towards taking a thing for what it is not. This can be corrected, it is said by Patanjali, with the dawning of discriminative knowledge, viveka khyati, and how exactly the idea of wrong cognition is shown to be the feature of any state of mind that touches upon desire, aversion, fear, or eye-sense is clearly indicated in the Yoga Sutra. So, asmita klesha is considered to be a viparyaya as it is responsible for taking the impermanent, anitya, to be the permanent or abiding, which is nitya. Here we make a wrong cognition in a very basic way, taking the impermanent to be that which is permanent in relationship to the individuality. It is raga klesha that gives rise to the erroneous view of taking the impure, the repulsive, asuchi, as pure and attractive suchi. The klesha called dvesha is responsible for not discriminating the really painful dukkha from that which is pleasing sukha, and abhinivesha for not discriminating the not-self, anatma, from the self which is atma. So these four afflictions, it is pointed out, are not always present in their fully manifest form. A distinctly psychological tone of description of the klesha found in chapter 2, sutra 4, is that klesha may be dormant, prasupta, attenuated, tanu, intercepted, vichinna, and fully manifest, udara. This is indeed a significant aspect of yoga analysis of klesha, which have a bearing on the study of emotion and therefore the experience of suffering. Before discussing the notion of asmita klesha, an interesting feature of yoga understanding of the mind, let me briefly review the idea concerning the raga dvesha abhinivesha, where the emotive core of the concept of klesha is quite obvious. The idea of samskara referred to earlier now comes to play an important role in this analysis. The traces of the experiences of pleasure are operative in and supportive of raga or desire. The modifications take the form of gardha, trishna, and lobha, which may be translated as longing, thirst, and greed, respectively. They also carry the nuance of hankering, attachment, infatuation, as is clear from the various examples used in the text. Metaphorically, the seeds of sukha samskara, or traces of pleasurable experiences, are now germinating, actively pushing, and this will give rise to states of desire, leading to efforts directed towards attainment of the objects of the pleasure. As opposed to desire, the emotive core of dvesha or aversion is provoked by the seed of recollection of pain. The state that arise are those of pratiga, manyu, jignasa, krodha, jighansa, not jignasa, jignasa is different, jighansa, krodha, which could be rendered in English as retaliation, malice, revenge, and anger. Thus, raga dvesha, attachment and aversion of desire and repulsion, dwell upon the sanskaras of pleasure and pain. The mind is not repelled by that which is pleasurable, nor does it desire which is that which is painful. It is caught in a constant push and pull of these two movements. The vrittis, when they are taking place, strengthen the samskaras, and the latter in turn facilitating the rise of the former. And in chapter number 2, sutra 9, Patanjali deals with a klesha called abhinivesha. The primary meaning of this term called abhinivesha in this context is stated in Vyasa's commentary to be the fear of death or the fear of annihilation, which is maranatrasha. It is said to be noted that the fear of death, abhinivesha, is not simply listed under dvesha, because that is what you would expect, that if it's some kind of fear, it would be classified under dvesha, which is an aversion. But it is not. And it is, abhinivesha is afflictive dread, which affects the learned as well as the ignorant. Unlike the sukha-dukha or pleasure-pain traces, of which examples are easily found in this life itself, the samskara or fear and anxiety concerning death cannot be so accounted for, there being no such experience in this life. In other words, why are we afraid of death when we have never experienced death? Right? So this, it is explained, the idea of previous death is then used to explain this persistent fear of death in the absence of any such experience in this life, arising naturally and spontaneously from the accumulated traces from death experiences of previous lives, those thus contributing to the sufferings in this life. Now, let us look at klesha that precedes desire, aversion, fear of death, and that which is placed next to in importance only to avidya or nescience, namely asmita, or the sense of I-am-ness, or the I-sense. It is perhaps easier to incorporate rag, dvesha, abhinivesha into the basic catalogues of emotion anywhere, but to consider asmita klesha as another mental phenomena requires a bit of further examination. This is a yogic view of mind that the I-sense, which is generated as a mental modification, can be analyzed into several different components. A set of ideas needs to be examined carefully in order not to lose this diverse implications of this concept of asmita. It appears in the three important contexts of yoga discourse. Number one, asmita is taken as tattva or a category of existence. Asmita is also taken as klesha or affliction. And then asmita is also mentioned in the sasmita samadhi, or the one-pointed concentration on the I-sense. The first usage is synonymous with ahamkara, or the ego principle, as in the Sankhya tradition. The Yoga Bhashya, chapter 219, lists it as the vishesha asmita matra. As a tattva, it shares with the five tanmatras the same characteristics, but we'll not go into that in the present because not really related to what we're talking about here. What concerns here is to grasp the sense in which the asmita or the I-sense, which is composite, but it appears as if it is one. Now, this is very much kind of central to the yoga philosophy. And the idea that there are two things appearing as one, which is called the ekatmata eva, is diagnosed as an affliction. The Yoga Sutra, chapter 2, number 6, defines it as drik darshan saktyor ekatmat eva asmita. So asmita is defined in this way. Looking upon the two principles, that the pure awareness, drikka shakti, and that of cognition, darshana shakti, as the same experience is called asmita. To put it in other words, the I-sense, which appears to be undivided and homogeneous, is generated by the non-distinction of two different ontological components, the experiencer and the experienced. Okay. Thus, the sense of I-ness and the my-ness, ahamkara and mamakara, are so intimately related and fundamental to the three kleshas, which follow that it may be said that there will be no desire or hatred or fear of the death without asmita. Asmita is very central to this whole idea of generation of suffering and klesha, affliction. And that I-ness actually arises from this misconception or the erroneous cognition that I am this homogeneous unit, but in fact, in reality, one is not. It is a component of the two things called Purusha and Prakriti. It may now be observed that the order of the arrangement of the kleshas is not arbitrary. Like everything else in Patanjali Yoga Sutra, you find it very systematically developed. Its significance may also be appreciated when viewed in the opposite order. So if we start off with the object of fear is in abhinivesha, that is to say the fear of death, is actually hated by everybody. This aversion, dvesha, is provoked when desire, raga, is thwarted. And that desire presupposes asmita or I-amness, which runs through the all three of these afflictions. To say that avidya or nescience, ignorance, is the soil for all these four is nothing but to say that the root cause of the phenomenal existence and the consequent suffering is nothing but this ignorance. This perspective brings forth an integral view of the mind where worldly existence, samsara, is not possible without the I-sense, desire, hatred and fear. These govern the mind of the individual and perpetuate the rotation of the wheel of samsara, and as long as the kleshas are present and functioning, suffering in the individual continues. To end all suffering is to end the root cause of suffering, which is avidya or ignorance. The egoistic expression of desire, hatred and fear cannot be controlled unless asmita klesha is subdued or weakened. It is therefore important to lay bare the real nature of this I-sense to show that it is not the immutable pure consciousness, the unchanging Purusha, that is, that it is erroneously taken to be, that is, that it is generated by the interplay of the self and the not-self. The passive Purusha and the active Buddhi, and ultimately the Samyoga or the conjunction of the Purusha and the Prakriti. In order to do justice to this complex set of ideas, one has to see how yoga practice gradually uncovers the two transcendental principles of Purusha and Prakriti through the Chitta Vritti Nirodha, or cessation of the modifications of the mind. So this is how we started off by asking the question, how, what is the relationship between the stilling of the mind and the disentanglement of the two principles. So here we see the solution, which Patanjali gives for the ending of all suffering is a cessation of the modifications of mind attained through the practice, abhyasa, and dispassion, vairagya. For the yogin, then, the bringing into awareness of these klesha and their effects in terms of the self-identity and the modifications and the attenuation through yoga practice is really the objective. The principle of klesha is an important foundation in the psychological understanding of the system of thought in Patanjali's yoga, as it points out the frame within which the mistaken phenomenal identity arises, with accompanying attachments, aversions, and the desire for perpetuation of life or the fear of extinction. Patanjali gives the prescription to overcome these klesha in verse number 10 of chapter 2. He says, these causes of affliction in their subtle form are to be overcome by the process of involution. Involution meaning that the prakriti which has evolved into these various components, we go take a reverse direction and go towards involution of this prakriti process. This process is described by Feuerstein as dissolving the consciousness through the prolonged practice of the various stages of meditation, starting with viveka, discriminative knowledge, removal of the gunas, attaining the increasing states of stillness of the mind until it is without any modification. In other words, it may be said that it is in that form of intense one-pointed concentration called sasmita samadhi that the heterogeneous constitution of the I-sense is observed. It is then disclosed that what was taken for simple, unchanging or stable is really composite and changing. This is the last of the highest stage of sampajnata samadhi, and this is where the yogi has now attained samadhi, where avidya or ignorance is completely destroyed and the kaivalya is achieved. Thus, yoga practices are designed to strengthen the aklishta samskara, which eventually subdue and eradicate the klesha or afflictions of I-sense, desire, hatred and fear, and the four faces of avidya, gradually assuring an undisturbed flow of the river called mind, which is called prashanta vahita sthiti, and this results in the gradual weakening of the klesha and decreasing of suffering. Nirodha, or cessation of all vrittis and the elimination of all karma and vasana, comes at the last stage of this spiritual endeavor, when the Purusha has been completely disentangled from the prakriti, reaching the state of kaivalya, and it is at this final stage, then this is the end of all suffering for all time. Thank you.
Patanjali,
what
time in what?
Sorry?
Patanjali.
Yeah. Which era? This was in the 6th century BC.
6th century BC.
Yeah.
And that is Amdev, the organizer of the Patanjali school.
Yeah. Ramdev. Yes. Ramdev is claiming that he is following Patanjali's, but of course, you know, we don't know exactly what he's up to. This is just to kind of bring all the things together, just in case, you know, it sounded very complicated and technical. This is a way in which I like to, you know, put all the ideas together. So here in the center of this is Chitta Vritti modifications of the mind. Don't worry about the back. This is all secret codes at the back. So here, if we look at the Chitravati modifications of the mind, and you can see there's a kind of line flowing across, which kind of distinguishes between the yogic states and the non-yogic states. And the Chittanadi, or the river of the mind, can flow in either direction. It can flow towards punya, actions of merit, through viveka or discrimination, leading towards aklishta vritti, unafflicted modification. Or the Chittanadi, river of the mind, can flow towards papa, actions of demerit, and through a viveka. So when we do things without any kind of discrimination, we are actually doing actions of demerit, and it leads towards klishta vritti, which is the afflicted modification. And these klishta vrittis are based on kleshas, like I was explaining that these are the five different types of klesha: asmita, raga, dvesha, abhinivesha, and avidya. Avidya is the basis, the root of all the other four. These are the four different faces of avidya. And these kleshas, when they actually carry on this kind of modification, give rise to karmasaya, which are impressions created through transactions with the world and result in samskaras and the vasanas. And these give rise to vikshepa, constant agitations, and also give rise to the nav antaraya, which is the nine obstacles. And you can see what different types of things arise. And we all kind of experience all these various different things. Vyadhi, bodily sickness, dhyana, listlessness, doubt, delusion, laziness, non-abstention, erroneous conception, non-attainment of yogic state, inability to stay in the yogic state. All this arises because, we got all these klishta vrittis going on, these modifications of the mind going on. But the main thing to remember, it gives rise to vikshepa, constant agitation in the mind, constant fluctuation in the mind, which result in these four things. Dukkha, which is the main thing, suffering, dor manasya, which is the dejection, kampayati, which is shakiness of the body, swasa praswasa, which is inhalation and exhalation. So disturbed flowing of the breath as well. And that is why some of the things which we see in Ashtang Yoga are actually based on removing this vikshepa. If we now look at the other side, and going further on the left-hand side, you can see the five states of mind which Patanjali describes are the muda, chipta, vikshipta, ekagra, and niruddha state. Okay, so going from stupefied state of mind to the disturbed state of mind, to the distracted state of mind, and to going towards one ekagrata, which is the one-pointedness, and towards niruddha. So the three which he mentions as a state of mind are the non-yogic state, where you cannot do anything. You cannot have concentration, nor can you go into deeper states of samadhi. In order to do that, you need to go into the yogic state of mind, which is the one-pointed state of mind and the stillness of the mind. Now, here I was talking about the perpetuation of the cycle of chitta-vritti and vyutthana samskara. Vyutthana samskara are those samskaras which are externalizing samskaras, which means I keep on looking to the outer world and relating to the outer world through this individuality. And that leads towards samsara, bondage, and suffering. If you go on the top of this dotted line, then we are going towards the yogic way of functioning in the world, right? So we have to use viveka, discrimination, and that gives rise to aklishta vritti, which are based on viveka khyati or discriminative knowledge. In other words, I know the difference between what is permanent, what is impermanent, what is real, what is unreal. All this discrimination takes place through viveka. And when I do that, what happens is that I get aklishta vritti, which are opposed to the gunas of nature. Now, these three gunas called sattva, rajas, and tamas are really the basis on which the whole of nature kind of functions, and these are called the modes of nature. And the idea is to purify these gunas to reach a sattvic state of mind. And we can see how Patanjali describes this purification process taking place, where we start with sthiti, which is full of tamas. This is lodged at the other end of the one end of the spectrum, the ignorant end of the spectrum, and with some rajas. And then we got pravritti, which is rajas and some tamas, and we got prakhya, which is rajas and some tamas, with mainly sattva. And then we got a state whereby there is only sattva. And this is where the chitta swasvarupa actually comes into existence. In other words, the chit is seen, actually seen for what it is. It comes back to its original nature without any kind of gunas playing it about. And then we get a state of no gunas, whereby Chitta Vritti Nirodha actually takes place. And this is where the Drashtu Swasarupa comes about, which means now the seer is abiding in its own self. Now this is the third sutra of the Patanjali Yoga Sutra, where he says the Drashtu actually comes back to its original position when the Chitta Vritti Nirodha takes place. Now, you can see how this whole idea of suffering is related to how you are functioning in the world. Okay, you can function in two ways. You can function as a yogi, and then lessening of suffering and eventual ending of all suffering. Or we can function in terms of a non-yogi, which is leading towards dukkha and suffering. And we can see the other cycle which goes on. If we have the chitta vritti and we practice yoga, then what we have is called the prajna samskara, which is samskara which are aklishta vritti, and which create traces or samskaras which are related towards to the true knowledge, which is prajna, and therefore it results in the reduction of the vrittis, and therefore gradual reduction of the vrittis leads towards the stillness of the mind, and then eventually there is no modification and it comes to a complete stillness of the mind. So that is basically the model of suffering from Yoga Sutra of Patanjali.
You stated initially at the beginning of the lecture there are three types of suffering: the adhyatmika, anirubhika, and bhadati. I studied in my early childhood, that is Titabdukku. But what exactly is Jwaravadi Mittu or something like that?
No, Adibhautik, Adidevik, and Adhyatmik. So these are relate to the three different classes causes of suffering. So when we talk about the these are called the Dukkha Traya.
Titabdukku.
Yeah. So Titabdukku, yeah. So Adhyatmik means that which is caused by internal, within the individual. So it can be physical. So, for example, if I've got a toothache, you know, that is an adhyatmic reason why I'm suffering. Okay, the adhibhautik is external. So, for example, if I'm feeling too much heat or too much cold or anything which is related to the external environment, that is adhibhautik, okay, belonging to the Buddha or the natural world. And then adhidevik is the supernatural causes, which means that, you know, there are certain influences which are coming, which we're not aware of, which come from different source altogether, which go beyond the world. Bhautik, beyond the bhautik, or the beyond the adhibhautik is the adhidevik. So these can be things which are coming from sources which are supernatural, not natural, but supernatural sources. So that can also create disturbances
in the mind. And that mind and physical illness all can be cured by the yoga where the Ramdev.
Yes, yes. So that's what it means. That, you know, the Ashtanga Yoga is a very systematic, holistic way of approaching the human individual in terms of taking him. So we got, you know, starting with yam and niyam, which means how do you transact with the world? Because external transactions are taking place all the time, right? So how do you actually format them in such a way that they become lead you towards the ultimate states of yoga? So starting from yam and niyam, he also touches on asana. Asana means, you know, physical exercises which balance the physical body. So transactions are balanced by the yam and the niyam. The body is balanced by the asanas, okay, various different types of asana. The prana is balanced by the various different pranic exercises, right? So that also affects the way in which the mind is functioning, because there's a close relationship between the body and the mind, according to Patanjali.
But pranayama is one type of yoga.
Pranayama. Yeah, so pranayama is also part of the Ashtanga Yoga. Pachana. Because, you know, then he goes on to asana, pranayama, pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. So these are the eight limbs of Ashtanga Yoga. So
samadhi is meditation. Huh?
Samadhi is deep absorption. It is a complete absorption in the object of meditation.
You mentioned the fear of death. I'm coming down to the very basic things. That while living, we have the fear of death. And therefore, that's probably because of the cycle of birth and rebirth. We've experienced death before the soul experienced it.
Yeah.
But how do you then explain that people who are living commit suicide?
Yeah. That's
which means they didn't have the. They may have had the fear of death. They wanted the death.
Yeah, yeah. So in other words, the fear of death is actually overcome by
Dharmanasya. Dejection.
Dejection, yeah. In other words, the suffering which is there is so much compared to even the fear of death, that the fear of death then becomes secondary to this kind of suffering which is taking place. In that case, that fear of death is overcome by this, suffering. It applies to any other thing which we do in our life. Is that, if there is one principle which is supersedes another one, then we are bound to act according to that principle than the other one.
But that explains, dejection would explain suicide.
Yeah.
But there are people who say, I've lived long enough. Please, oh Lord, take me away. I've had enough.
Yeah. So.
But they don't commit suicide, but they wish it.
Sure. But, right? But suffering which is there, which makes them to sing, I've had enough. Right? And he says, I've had enough, therefore I want to end this life. Now that ending, that suffering is now much more than the fear of death. But the fear of death is still there. This is the point.
Yeah, there are two types of people, right?
That's
I
right.
first
yeah.
talked about suicide.
Yeah. Yeah.
Those
yeah.
who wish death but yeah. don't die, yeah. don't commit
yeah.
suicide.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they still have the fear of death.
That's right.
Because they could, if they wanted, wanted to get rid of it, could do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But could either of those be explained? Or does Patanjali try to explain it by saying it is the desire to see the next life?
No, he doesn't actually touch on either of these points.
On the chakra, he doesn't.
No. Uh-huh. He doesn't touch on suicide and things like that. Mm-hmm. But he says that any aspect of the thinking process, all the modifications which are taking place, if we categorize them as erroneous thinking of the non-enlightened state, mm-hmm. which means that all these things are really leading us towards, suffering. Now, how these are kind of balanced, or they are, as I was saying, they can be, dormant, these five kleshas, they can be dormant, they can be, attenuated, or they can be fully expressed. So the fear of death, for example, at this moment, we are not feeling any fear of death. Explicitly, it is not in our experience at this moment. So it is lying dormant. But come across anything which now, for example, if we have some kind of terminal illness, what will happen? The fear of death comes into full swing. Okay, so various different ways of expression of these five kleshas will come about. And it means that, one time or the other, the expression of these things will be either dormant, or it is fully expressed, or in between somewhere.
Okay.